Digital 410 Media proudly presents the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast with your hosts, Don Abernathy, Jeff Copsetta, and Dennis Blocker.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of the What's the Scuttlebutt podcast, your favorite World War II-based podcast. And we are back, all three of us here once again. Jeff, Dennis, how y'all doing?
Doing good. Yeah, doing good.
Great. Great to be back with you guys. You know, like, I've got the same excuse all the time. Freaking homework and work. So thank goodness Dennis is here to help kind of pick up my slack.
As soon as I did the intro, my phone started ringing. I'm like, come on, are you kidding me? That's why I threw my hands up. My brother's calling me. I'm like, come on now. No, happy to have you guys back. You know, every few days or so, we throw out a chat saying, hey, what do we want to talk about on this week's episode? And I think, Jeff, you pointed out the fact, or maybe Dennis did. I can't remember. I was driving on the street when it came through. Yeah, Jeff, well, you know, of course, it's the 80th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz. And so, good topic. And this morning, I was at work, and I just so happened to put on YouTube, streaming, the Auschwitz Memorial Museum 80th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz live stream. So I turn it on, and if I end up putting the video version of this podcast, you guys will see it. But behind me, I went on Google and took a screenshot because it doesn't look, this doesn't give it anything of the clarity. But this is the recreation that's at the museum a few miles down the road. And they had a huge tent set up. And all these just rows and rows of dignitaries, survivors, and people. And then they have guest speakers up there. And I didn't tune in for the beginning. I didn't know it was on. It's on, and they're having different survivors come up and tell their stories. And they pan the audience, and this shot just kind of brought the realism to me, right? They're panning the audience, and you got these survivors, and they have like the blue and white striped handkerchiefs around the neck, marking the fact that they're survivors of concentration camps. But one of them, I don't know if it's a recreation. I don't think anybody makes them. I don't know if it's from a movie. Or somehow he had his original, one of the survivors had on that striped hat. And it really, it was just like, ooh. It's like, oh, wow. Seeing this, you know, 92-year-old guy wearing that hat. It's like, it was like, oh, yeah, this is real. And just listening to the survivors talking about their experience. Because depending on how old they were, they had one woman up there who was, I think, 12. On Liberation Day, she's talking about, you know, how they're exterminating people and rounding up people, and they're getting to send her group next, and then that's when, you know, the sirens went off and all the guards just skedaddled, and it was just a really beautiful presentation. I'm sure the whole thing is on YouTube now. It was live streaming, and like I said, I didn't see the beginning, and I don't know if they mentioned or introduced it, but they're showing us one group of people, and I'm like, oh, there's King Charles III, Zelensky, Ukrainian president, was in the audience, and they keep panning, and I'm like, I don't recognize anybody other than those two, and I'm like, you know, did we send anybody over? Turns out Trump did create members of the presidential delegation. But to be honest with you, there's like 9 or 10 people in there, and it's not names that I recognized, but we did send about 9 people over there for it. But it was very well done. And so that's what that shot is behind me. That's just the internal inside the tent that they had set up, and in the archway, they actually have one of the train cars. So one of the survivors was talking about being put on the train cars on the way there. You know, they're zooming in on it, and it was... it was really well done, and a good reminder, you know, because the whole Holocaust Memorial, their slogan is, you know, never again. And that was kind of like the theme, and it was really well done. But, yeah, so I just figured we'd take this episode to kind of talk about the details of Auschwitz and in general, and how the whole thing came to be and what it turned into and how the liberation came to come to fruition. I don't know if you guys have anything you want to add in to start this thing off before we get going.
Well, you know, this is definitely a topic that is not something I'm really you know, in tune with. It's this is definitely more my wife's interest. I gave her an invite fruitlessly to talk about all the books that she's read on the topic and her interest and what draws her to it, right? Like, we can't explain why we're drawn into the things that we are, you know, but we are. We don't know why, but for her, it's this topic. But I think Auschwitz specifically for me just always kind of rings as just that irony, I guess, of the liberation of Auschwitz being, you know, coming from the Russians and knowing the kind of internal terror, I guess, that was going on over there it's I don't know, it's just kind of it's interesting how history plays out sometimes.
Well, and for those at the audience, Jeff and I aren't smirking or laughing at the topic. We're smirking, as Jeff said, the irony, because we know that Stalin and Russians kind of had their own equivalent of the Final Solution that they wanted to, you know, initiate on the Jews in Russia. And so, as Jeff's saying, it's kind of ironic that they were the first ones to kind of inadvertently lead this charge and proceed to the rescuing and the liberation of this camp.
Yeah, same here. You know, it's not something that I, you know, put a lot of research into or anything like that. However, you know, I specifically remember when we grew up, when I lived in Iceland. So I was, you know, 8, 9, 10 years old there. There was a mini series that came out, and it was one of those limited series, and it was called Holocaust. And it was a it wasn't a documentary. And it was very impactful to me as a young lad because I had already seen Von Ryan's Express. And so, you know, that's what everybody who knows me would knows that that's the movie that got me started into World War II, loving the because of the way the German uniforms really caught my attention because they're so sharp. And the British and they're always trying to escape, and the Americans are just cocky and, you know, and taking charge and, you know, getting things done. And so I was kind of like, yeah, this is, and then the Holocaust. And I was just that. I mean, it's been, goodness gracious, it's 30, you know, 40 years since I've seen it in Iceland. I still remember that vividly to this day. The depictions there, and yeah, it was really something. I've been thinking a lot about it today when Jeff recommended that we do this podcast episode today, and it's been on my mind. Interestingly enough, while I was at work, I heard there was someone says, "Hey, you have a guest at the door," and it was a gentleman that I had met who was has a nonprofit in town, and he brought in a friend of his who was kind of a chief executive officer of this nonprofit, and they wanted to get some of our support, this and that. Brought them in, and the two gentlemen sit in my office, and the guy looks up and he sees my Eisenhower coffee mug that Conan O'Brien made famous on his late night show that was always sitting on his desk. And so he's like, "Eisenhower, you know, this other guy," and but he says it with this accent and it sounded French. And then he says, "Look at the," and he started talking about, "Oh, look at the P-40 there," and this and that. Of course, you know, so that we're off to the races. And come to find out, his he's going to Normandy in 2 days, and he's from France, and the area of France he was from, his grandfather was in the resistance, and what his grandfather would do is he would retrieve parts of V2s and V1s that were shot out of the sky or that had malfunctioned and crashed before making it across. And he would smuggle these parts to make it back to England so the scientists could study them. And he's heading over to France because he's going to research his grandfather's story and get access to these archives. And so that started us off on what we were talking about tonight. And it was very interesting because it was like Jeff's was, "Let's talk about Auschwitz." And then, boom, this guy shows up at my door on the day we're going to have the podcast, and his grandfather was in the resistance. And sometimes it's a very, very small world, you know, it's really something.
Jeff, you're saying your wife has, you know, this particular corner of World War II history is the one that kind of jumps out to her. And we've all talked in the past about how we can't explain why things, the particular things about World War II affects each one of us or grabs our attention. But when you're talking about your wife's interest in it, the only thing I popped in my mind, and maybe you could ask her, obviously, military at the time was completely different than it is now. And so I think World War II and early military history affects men in a certain way because in our minds, if we were there at that age, we could have possibly been there. And it's, we're trying to look at it like, you know, how would this affect me? Yada, yada, yada. Whereas with the exception of the home front or maybe living in a battlefield, battle area or a country that's being invaded, it's kind of harder for a woman or a mom to put themselves in that situation, but to think, holy hell, what would it be like as a mom to have you and all five of your kids scooped up and put in this situation? And I think there's probably more mother perspectives in this particular angle of the war overall, collectively, than there are, you know, civilian diaries of, you know, air raids and like, I think like that. You think that's possible that it's just coming from a woman's view of what it would be like or how it would impact your family? This is probably the most scariest, horrible, you know, aspect of what could possibly happen to a family during that time.
I think it's the most horrifying, scary thing that could happen to anybody in any point in history.
But you know what I mean,
though,
right? It's, I think it's probably perhaps more, this particular thing is something more that, you know, perhaps a woman could relate to at that time just because of the entire families are being rounded up, right? You have kids being taken away from their moms and all that stuff. And it's like just, I don't know, perhaps when it comes to this part of the war, maybe it's a little bit more associated than, you know, reading foxhole frontline stuff.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that, and I know, and we'll talk about them, I'm sure, here at the end. And I've got a couple books that are her recommendations on the subject, and they're all written by female, you know, survivors. And I think that's interesting. I don't know the statistics as far as how many, you know, guys' stories were put into print. I know of a couple, but I'm kind of curious to know those statistics. Because even two people go through the same event, and it's two different events, right? That's just the human story. But then when you throw in the factor of a guy going through this in a work camp, and then his wife being shipped off to another camp, you know, with women and children, for me, and I don't, like I said, I don't know how it gets any scarier than it already is, but when you put children into any story, it just takes on another level of terror. So it's interesting to think about some of those things and what really written records would have survived and why they've survived. So it's an interesting thought for sure.
Well, I was trying to do a cursory research, but I couldn't come up with anything because I can't figure out the magic Google wording. But I was, as you're saying that, I'm wondering, well, what was the population density between men versus women in these camps? Because obviously ages 14 to 30-ish, you could be used in forced labor camps. You could be used on the front line in some parts. And so you would think the Germans would utilize young men and early stage men in a different way than they would women. So I wonder, once again, I couldn't find the numbers because I don't know the wordage Google wants, but it'd be curious to see what was the population density in these camps. Was there 60% women and 30% dudes? Was it 70% guys and 40% women? Cause they're exterminating the women population quicker. It'd be interesting to see how those population differences, because back to my previous point, if we were to find out hypothetically that in these camps routinely, they had more women because they're utilizing the men in different ways, then that would kind of go to the hypothesis of that's why, you know, we reread a lot more post-war publications about women survivors from these camps versus the men. But I couldn't, you know, it'd be interesting if I could track down that statistic because I never really thought about it before.
Yeah, certainly an interesting thought. And it's interesting to think too, like, at what point did the intel start rolling in, right? Like, at what point did we start understanding the magnitude of what was being found by the Russians and then, of course, by American soldiers? Because there's no backstory to it, right? Like, you just, we see it in hindsight, which is always a perfect 20/20 vision. But it's interesting to think about, you know, there was probably guys on the ground, boots on the ground, that had no idea of the concept that we know of today. And they were there, right? They just, but you don't understand the magnitude. You don't see that full picture. So that's something else to take into effect, too. It's just, man, it's, I was hesitant to suggest this subject, I'll be honest. We've talked a lot of World War II over the years. Don and I, we go way back. You know, Walking Point's now 6 years old next month. So we go back, man. And I don't think we've really, together, we've covered this. And I've shied away from it, you know, just the nature and the sensitivity of it. But I think today it is fitting to help maybe try to educate a few more listeners, hopefully, and maybe get a few more, you know,
Well, I got some stats and some
more interest, I guess, in it.
I got some stats and some numbers we'll go over just to kind of paint a broad, a little bit of a broader picture. But before we do, thought I had, you know, at the beginning when Jeff and Dennis were talking about, you know, this isn't really our strong point of study when it comes to World War II. And in my mind, I'm thinking, well, why is that? And once again, these are just things that boil up in my mind as we're doing this live. I think it's just because the subject matter is just so hardcore and horrific. The descriptions, the photos, and somebody standing by and say, well, how war is horrible too. It's like, yeah, war is horrible. Combat photos are horrible, but in our minds, we can justify them as, hey, that's an enemy, or they can look at the photos of our dead. That's an enemy. We're in conflict. But you look over here and it's like, these are civilians that are rounded up, tortured, and executed for absolutely no reason other than ideology. And looking at battlefield photos are horrible enough, but looking at concentration camps, it's like, this is the evidence of the most horrible shit one human can do to another. And you can't justify it. There's not like, well, that's the enemy. That's what. No, it's unjustifiable. It's unexplainable how a group of people could do that to another group of people. And so seeing those photos and reading those details, these firsthand accounts, and we've talked about this with the death marches in the Pacific, just reading those POW camp stories, hearing about, you know, the Bataan Death March, just reading what happened to those guys at that level is hard enough. You know, it's always harder to read about people getting tortured from one group versus the other versus, you know, combat, this is what happened. And so I think that's, for me at least, that's why it's so hard to dig into this particular topic as far as leisure reading goes outside of a podcast and getting to know. It's just so much more hard emotionally to invest in this particular topic, at least for me.
Absolutely.
So
yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And then also, when you have kids, you just, you know, I can't help but I put myself there. And one of the worst feelings you could ever have is a helpless feeling. You just have to witness things happen to your loved ones and you can't do anything about it. And everything within you is just struggling to fight. And you're looking up into the sky, hoping that some miracle happens. And cause you realize that there is absolutely nothing I can do. And you're watching it. So there's just nothing about, there's no ridge that was taken. There was no liberated town there that we get to and read about with these other stories or acts of, it's just one horrific day after another, and it's all meted out on these civilians, and it's just
something I'd like
needs to be told, though. It needs to be told, and because it's a very slippery slope between
absolutely
cancel culture and that's just an example, and I'm not a political guy at all. You can look at my Facebook. There is nothing political on there. But since we're talking about this subject, you can see how easy it is, the slippery slope between people getting canceled, people getting thrown in prison for having a different opinion, and the law being used against them to shut down their businesses and shut down their homes, and people have lost their livelihoods and their careers have been shattered just simply because they had an opinion. And look at what happened to Jordan Peterson up in Canada. I mean, it's very slippery slope, and we say, well, it will never happen again, and events happen all over the world. Events happen all over the world all the time still.
That's one of the things.
That's why I'm so I was very encouraged with the country spoke and said, let's pump the brakes on this, and that morality took hold, because there is a very scary, slippery slope. And if you haven't spoke to people who were there, I mean, I've put IVs in people that had these tattoos on their wrists, their arms, their forearms. I spoke with these folks and had the opportunity, and you know, that's why I'm really glad that we're doing this. I'm really glad that we're doing this.
You know, my brother is substantially older than me. I think when he was in sixth grade, I was like in first, maybe kindergarten. And so when we were in Kentucky in the 80s, he was probably in fifth or sixth grade. And so he was old enough for the history class. And so they would actually have, because they would be in their 30s, 40s, and 50s at this point, they would have Holocaust survivors come and talk to the history class and show them the tattoos and give them their firsthand account. And wow. So he had the benefit of being old enough and so young enough to have that as part of his fifth, sixth grade history curriculum, whereas clearly I'm kindergarten. You'd hear the older kids talk about it, and looking back on it now, it's crazy to think. I just want to go over some stats here real quick, just so first let me actually, I did this today, and it's, we talk about, you know, seeing battlefields in real life and how it kind of brings a different aspect to it. You want to bring a different aspect to this, go on Google Maps and type in Auschwitz. It's right there overhead. Obviously, a lot of it's gone, but you can see the outlines, and a lot of it's a museum now, but like you can see little pinpoints on Google Maps, like up the road, and you click on it, and it's like Auschwitz Red House, going by names that the people who were there gave, and then down on the southwest corner is a little purple pin, you click on it, it says Auschwitz II White House. Now it's just a little foundation, the houses are gone, but you can see different areas around the compound, and today, this, you zoom out, and today this is dead nuts in the middle of a metropolitan area. And so it kind of brings that realism to us. Once again, we're all used to looking at digital stuff, media, YouTube, what have you, to go look at this grounds on Google Maps and just, you know, mouse around the town. It just brings it, once again, to realism. Auschwitz was established initially as a concentration camp in 1940. Near Auschwitz, Poland, as a Nazi concentration camp. The order was, the order to establish Auschwitz was issued by Heinrich Himmler on April 27th, 1940. Initially, the construction was carried out by Polish prisoners, primarily political detainees who were transported from Tarnów prison in June of 1940. Over time, the labor force expanded to include Jewish prisoners, Soviet POWs, and other detainees forced into labor under brutal conditions. You know, I was looking at this on Google Maps, and so I was curious, was this wilderness at the time? Now it's metropolitan area, but was this wilderness at the time? Was it a prison camp? Where did the land come from? The site was chosen in the outskirts, but the land for the camp was confiscated by the Nazis, including the forced evacuation of local Polish residents and the destruction and or repurposing of existing properties. What was the initial purpose? Because, you know, we found out things didn't really ramp up until the whole final solution, but what was the original purpose of the camp? The camp was initially intended to house Polish political prisoners, but expanded into a complex network of camps, including Auschwitz II, Birkenau, designed as a forced labor camp, extermination, and systematic genocide. Existing Polish military barracks were adapted for use in the early phases of construction. So key parts of the compound, you have Auschwitz I, which is the administration center and site of the experiments that we've heard about, you know, the experiments that were conducted as part of the Nazi insanity and their science and their desire for, what do you call that? The, doesn't matter. I forget the term for the science where you're trying to create a specific, you know, type of person. Auschwitz II, Birkenau was the largest section designed for the extermination camps, and then Auschwitz III, Monowitz labor camp for IG Farben chemical factories. Forced labor. Prisoners were used as a slave labor in various industries, including synthetic rubber and fuel production. Medical experiments, as we previously said, human experiments were conducted, notably by Joseph Mengele, on vulnerable populations like twins, pregnant women, and the disabled. Extermination, gas chambers, and cremations were conducted at Birkenau for systematic mass murder, primarily of Jews and also Romani people, Poles, Soviet Poles, and others. In the days leading up to the Nazi decision to evacuate the concentration camp, the situation was dire in Germany. Allied forces were advancing rapidly from both the east and the west, and the collapse of the Third Reich seemed to be inevitable. The Soviets advanced on Auschwitz in January 1945. As the Red Army was closing in on the complex, by mid-January 1945, Soviet forces were within, I believe, about 50 miles. They say striking distance, but one of the young ladies at the time, but who was given her experience at the memorial today, said that they were about 50 miles away. The Nazis were aware the liberation by the Allies would expose the full scale of their atrocities. The Nazis became increasingly chaotic as German faced defeat. Orders from Berlin to local commanders emphasized the need to destroy the evidence and prevent prisoners from being liberated. And they, their main desire was to destroy the evidence before the Russians got there, which led up to the evacuations. The SS guards began burning documents, dismantling gas chambers, and destroying all evidence of mass murder and attempt to cover up their crimes. And so as the Allies were coming in, they basically got any personnel who could walk or be dragged to do a forced march. As previously stated, to try to cover up the atrocities and to prevent witness statements. But as I learned today too, the Germans looked at these detainees as labor force. And so they wanted to relocate as many of them as they could so they could send them off to work in factories to further try to increase their production. And so, yeah, they were trying to maintain slave labor. The total death count, they're saying approximately 1.1 million people perish at Auschwitz. But as one of the survivors was saying, because she was giving her speech, and she cited that number. She said, you know, the history states that people believe that 1 million people died there. She said, but I can tell you, because I was there and I've talked to other survivors, there were days when trains pulled up, the people were taken directly off the trains, were not going through any registration, they went straight to the chambers. And so she said that she believes, and other survivors believe, that the true number of people who perished there will never be known, because the amount of them that were never stopped and registered. You know, we always hear about the bookkeeping and the in-depth registration and maintaining. I guess at a certain point, they would just get right off the trains and just walk them straight to the gas chambers. No counting numbers. I'm sure maybe somewhere along the line they had numbers. But, you know, this one survivor, you know, she believes that it's way more than a million. But according to the factual reports, approximately 1.1 million people perished. Majority of these were Jews. Other victims include 74,000 Poles, 21,000 Romani, 15,000 Soviet POWs, and others. And so that's just some of the numbers that came out of this one particular compound. And I think, as Jeff was saying earlier, and as we all know, this was just one of many, many camps throughout the war that we discovered and that were liberated. And it seemed like later parts of the war, more and more of these camps were being discovered. And as Jeff says, you know, at what point the leaks and rumors kind of come into the paperwork where it was like, oh, wow, this is wasn't just a one-off site prison camp that had some people in charge and went crazy. This was a systematic machine. And I don't know. That's just, that has to be mind-boggling, right?
Yeah.
And as they said in Band of Brothers, they titled that episode, Why We Fight. That's in the book, the chapter is Why We Fight, because up until then, you know, a lot of the guys earlier, they weren't quite sure, but now they knew. And it's just mind-blowing.
Eisenhower was a pretty level-headed guy. When he saw that, he ordered all them people to go through there. He ordered all the civilians to go through and see all the Germans, get in there and clean it up. He was so angry. Yeah, and he didn't want anybody saying that it didn't happen. And one of my favorite TV shows growing up was a comedy, and is Hogan's Heroes. And I have all the seasons here. I got this awesome DVD collection. I can't see it because of the screen, but it's the complete series of Hogan's Heroes. And I'm looking at the cover there, and it got me to thinking today about the actors on that. Leon Askin, he played General Burkhalter. He was always the overweight general who would show up, and they would always threaten him with telling Hitler this and that. And Leon Askin was a Austrian Jew who fled to America in 1940, and he joined the Army Air Corps. His parents were killed at Treblinka. And Robert Clary, who famously played the Frenchman Louis Le Beau, Robert Clary, his parents died at Auschwitz, and 12 of members of his family. And he survived Buchenwald because he had a talent. He could sing.
Mm-hmm.
And he would sing every other weekend to the SS guards in their dorm, accompanied by an accordionist. John Banner, who famously played Sergeant Schultz, was an Austrian Jew and who fled to America in around 1938-39. He joined the Army Air Corps, U.S. He was a supply sergeant. Almost all of his family perished in concentration camps.
Someone sent
Werner Klemperer, who was Colonel Klink.
Hold on, I want to stop real quick, just because somebody sent me this. That gentleman who played Sergeant Schultz, those with a keen eye for military weaponry already know this, but this was pointed out to me. He refused to carry a German weapon in Hogan's Heroes because Poland and Austria were overtaken by Germany, so he carried a Krag instead, which is similar.